My name is Velocity Child. Welcome to Fallen Woman on Radio Free Brooklyn. This is a special storytelling edition tonight. I will be sharing with you a variety of tales. To start with, I'm going to open with a special love of mine, Dr. Seuss. A unique story he wrote called The Seven Lady Godivas. And here we go. History has treated no name so shabbily as the name Godiva. Today, Lady Godiva brings to mind a shameful picture. A big blonde nude trotting around the town on a horse. In the background of this picture, there are always peeping Toms, an illicit snooper with questionable intentions. The author feels that the time has come to speak. There was not one, there were seven Lady Godivas. And their nakedness actually was not a thing of shame. So far as Peeping Tom is concerned, he never really peeped. Peeping was merely the old family name. And Tom and his six brothers bore it with pride. A beautiful story of love, honor, and scientific achievement has too long been gathering dust in the archives. Love, Dr. Seuss, Coventry, 1939. Chapter 1, Old Lord Godiva. On the 15th of May, in the year 1066, Lord Godiva, Earl of All Coventry, summoned his daughters to appear before him in the Great North Hall of the Castle Godiva. For a long silent moment, he regarded them proudly, for the seven daughters of Lord Godiva had brains. Nowhere, he thought with satisfaction, could there be a group of young ladies that wasted less time upon frivol and froth, no fluffy duff primping, no feather, no fuss. They were simply themselves and chose not to disguise it. Girls, announced Lord Godiva, today I leave for the Battle of Hastings. And, he added calmly, I am going by horseback. Horseback! The sisters looked nervously from one to another. In that day in England, the horse was not taken lightly. True, Lord Godiva had been experimenting with these animals for years, but the horse remained a mystery, unbroken in spirit, a contrary beast full of wiles and surprises. Come, come, chided Lord Godiva, rattling his spurs. Don't be so old-fashioned. This is 1066. Definitely, I shall attend the battle on horseback. Lord Godiva had spoken. His metal feet clanked as he led his daughters to the courtyard. Their bare feet followed, cold on the cobbles. Waiting and saddled stood Nathan, his war horse. From the eye holes in his hood gear, he watched the group approaching. Nice horse, smiled Lord Godiva, holding out a lump of sugar. Nathan ignored it. He looked sullen and foreboding. Lord Godiva put the sugar back in the pocket of his armor. He climbed into the saddle and aimed for the drawbridge. Nathan started off in a sideways sort of trot. Good luck, shouted the girls, waving their handkerchiefs. To victory, shouted Lord Godiva, brandishing his broadsword but everyone must have shouted too loud. Nathan reared, his front knees dipped low, and his hind knees flew high. He pitched Lord Godiva, Earl of all Coventry, spurs over breastplate, off on his helm. By the time his daughters reached him, the old warrior was dead. Like any normal daughters, the Godiva sisters wept. Then they stiffened their shoulders and faced the facts. Their father was gone, destroyed by a horse. The girls were left with a grim obligation. Horses must be studied and charted, made safe for posterity. Seven hands clasped over Lord Godiva's remains. Seven tongues spoke. Seven pledges were uttered. "I swear," swore each, "I shall not wed until I have brought to the light of this world some new and worthy horse truth of benefit to man." It was an oath of heroic proportions. How long this horse truth quest might take was something no Godiva knew. But each one knew she was sad and sick at heart. Each one was in love. Each one betrothed. That night, when the seven peeping brothers came to court, their ladies, all doors of the castle, Godiva, were bolted. Nailed to every door was a copy of the oath. Very sadly, Peeping Tom, Peeping Dick, Peeping Harry, Peeping Jack, Peeping Drext, Peeping Sylvester, and Peeping Fraglerheisen each dropped his bouquet into the moat. Then they all went home to wait. Chapter 2, Teeny Godiva. The next morning, Hedwig awoke in the chill of dawn. "I am the eldest," she thought as she brushed her teeth. "I must manage these oaths in a systematic way." She cut sheets of parchment and stitched them together. She bound them with care in a cover of rawhide. To the top of this volume, she hitched a bronze chain. Then she knocked at her sister's doors. "Follow me," said Hedwig. Just that and nothing more. Six solemn Godivas followed Hedwig to the stables. Hedwig hung the volume just outside the stable door. Then she showed them the contents, exactly seven pages, and each one a blank. "Somewhere there are horse truths," Hedwig said briefly. "Each of us must find out one and inscribe it on her page. An oath has been sworn. That oath shall be kept. So long as your page remains empty of horse truth, so shall your life remain empty of love." A terrible silence filled the stable courtyard. The mind of each Godiva was far away with her peeping. Hedwig stamped her foot. "Enough with this wishy-washy schoolgirl mourning." "To horse," she shouted, and plunged into the barn. A clatter of hoofbeats rang through the yard. Over the drawbridge, they made for the fields. Through the fens and the bracken, through the thistle and the gorse, through moorland and marshland, the great quest was on. But Teeny Godiva was not with the others, left behind, left alone, left unnoticed. Teeny was too fat for any horse to carry. She sat down on a small pile of oats and wept. Her prospects added up badly indeed. No horse truth, no peeping, no nothing. By and by, the oats became very uncomfortable. Teeny got up and went into the stable. Dejected, she wandered past stall after stall. Out in the sunlight, her sisters were trotting, galloping, cantering, earning their love right. Here it was hot, and the horses dozed drearily. No cooperation, she sighed, as she trudged down the aisles. At Teeny's elbow, a lazy mare yawned, an enormous crude yawn, uncouth and ill-mannered. Teeny stalked on. Then she sensed something strange, and she stopped and looked back. The yawn, to her amazement, was still going on. Wider and wider the beast's jaw stretched open, the yawn of all yawns. It blossomed, it bloomed from gape stage to gape stage, from gape stage to gape gop. At last, it reached its zenith and froze there ajar. Teeny had never seen anything like it. I say, puzzled Teeny, maybe this isn't a yawn after all. The horse almost seemed to be inviting inspection. She stopped up to the mare. It stood still, obliging. And she stepped up quite close and peered down its windpipe. When her sisters returned to the castle for lunch, they found Teeny in bed. From the crown of her head to the scruff of her neck, she was swathed deep in bandages, ointment, and lint. "Nose gone," she said simply. "Teeny, poor Teeny," gasped her horrified sisters. "Poor Teeny, nothing." A radiant smile filtered up through the gauze. "You know that mare Uncle Ethelbert gave us last Christmas? With the help of the darling, I filled in my page." "A horse truth?" "A great one," said Teeny. "Don't ever look a gift horse in the mouth." In spite of the fact she was in no shape for kissing, Teeny Godiva married Peeping Tom that very night. Chapter 3. Dorcas J. Godiva. In their bachelor household each morning, the Peepings were in high, helpful spirits. A horse truth had been consummated on the very first day. "At this rate," rejoiced the brothers, "we'll all be married within the week." And at breakfast in the castle, Arabella, Mitzi, Lulu, Gussie, and Hedwig Godiva simply bubbled with cheer. The horse truth quest was going to be easy. But Dorcas J. Godiva sat cool and unemotional. "It was a fluke, girls," she declared. "Teeny was just plain lucky. And if you're planning to loaf around the barns and let the horses do the thinking, I warn you, girls, right here and now, you'll never win your peepings. Research, believe me, is our one and only answer." "What research?" Lulu, puzzled, looked up from her herring. "Research," explained Dorcas, "is the concentrated examination and correlation of the multitudinous phenomena coexistent in some specific field of activity. For my field, I have selected the study of horse-drawn vehicular transportation. Her sisters were not interested, leaving them to loll and lounge in the stables, waiting for horse truths to drop into their laps. The analytical Godiva plunged into her research. In buggies and trumbles and sulkies and chaises, she rumbled through the highways and byways of Coventry. Each day, a different vehicle, each day, the selfsame horse, and she watched his every action with a sharp and eager eye. But Fidwick, her horse, was a hard nut to crack. Stolid and placid, he pulled without emotion. His truths, if he should have such, he kept to himself. My wagons, thought Dorcas, must be made more provoking. Fidwick was smug and needed a jolt. So she rigged up a gig she called Wagon Superior. She constructed the wagon part purposely low so that every fourth step, when his hindquarters rose, the board slapped a rhythmic tattoo on his rump. Dorcas was right. Fidwick's smugness was visibly shaken. In his eyes, she detected a flicker of protest. She determined to pique him a little bit more. She rigged up a gig called Wagon Inferior. Fidwick objected with ill humor and scorn. He had just about become accustomed to the wagon up on top, and now the wretched woman had slung one down below, down between his knees. So he had to trot wide in a disgraceful, undignified, bow-legged gait. His mood at the end of the day was just foul. Dorcas was elated. In the smoldering depths of his mounting distemper, something was brewing, and it might be a horse truth. So she went a step further. This gig she rigged up, she called Wagon Anterior. Never, from a horse's point of view, had a vehicle been constructed with less consideration. The whole crazy business was backside, too. Giddy-ap, called Dorcas, as offensively as possible. That giddy-ap for Fidwick was the very last straw. He saw red, he saw orange, he saw green, blue, and violet. Something in Fidwick virtually exploded. In the greatest horse and tree conflict that Coventry has ever known, Dorcas J. Godiva discovered horse truth number two. Don't, was its substance. Put the cart before the horse. Her wedding, however, was postponed for some time. It took more than 5 months to remove the splinters to make the Lady of Research reasonably safe for Peeping Dick. Chapter 4. Arabella Godiva. If ever a horse had reason to take to drink, it was Brutus. Arabella was wearing the poor devil down. So anxious was she to wed Peeping Harry that even while she slept, she worked the horse like mad. Nightly, she would sleepwalk down to the stables, and all night she would sleep trot over the hills. Brutus, of course, cracked under the strain. Somehow he had learned that the fermented mash at the bottom of the silo had a soothing, consoling effect upon his troubles. So, whenever he got the chance, he'd tip hoof stealthily around to the silo and indulge himself in a little quiet lapping. In no time at all, Brutus had degenerated into a drunken bum. Look at him! Look at him!" cried Arabella one morning. Brutus was suffering the most extravagant hangover ever experienced by man or beast. He lay sprawled on his rumpled straw, his eyes bloodshot, his nostrils a-quiver. He addled head-swam, devoid of all horse sense. As a colleague in science, he was no help at all. "He's a drunk," said Arabella, "and I want another horse." But Hedwig spoke up sharply. "Arabella, I've known Brutus since he was a colt, so I. What Brutus is today, you yourself have made him. You'll stick to him through thick and thin. Come along, girls." Arabella's sister stalked out of the barn. Arabella frowned at the old besotted Brutus. Through this dissipated hulk lay her only road to freedom. Brutus, she realized, would have to be reformed. "Oh, for goodness sake," she snapped. "Make a horse of yourself." She tugged at his halter. Slowly, painfully, he staggered to his feet. He swayed there, weaving on four legs of rubber. Through the open window, he caught a glimpse of the silo. His murky eyes brightened. "Oh, no, you don't," shouted Arabella, and she dragged the poor creature straight out to the pump. "Pump stuff," shuddered Brutus. "I'll die before I touch it." He did. Arabella phrased her horse truth in the oath book very neatly. "You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink." Then, underneath, she scribbled in a big, conceited scrawl, "By the time you old maids read this, I'll be Mrs. Peeping Harry." Chapter 5. Mitzi Godiva. "Mitzi, my sweet," wrote able-bodied seaman Peeping Jack from his perch in the crow's nest of the bouncing Queen Maeve, plying the trade routes of the Ultima Thule. "It's 7 years now. How about that horse truth? Your true love, Peeping Jack." He sealed the letter with a kiss and posted it the next week in the port of Bru Na Boing. From Bru Na Boing to Queen Silien to Brineg Lag to Thwilon Thrain, by sea skiff post and Oxtron Dray, the love note came to Coventry. It reached Mitzi in the stable on Midsummer's Day, that dreadfully hot August of 1073. As she read the brisk, fresh words, Mitzi was transported. The stables, the horses, all drifted away. She heard the shrill pipe of seagulls, felt the tang of salty spray. The surge of mighty rollers roared in her ears. She thought of lobsters and clams. Mitzi Godiva was a true sailor's sweetheart. The vision faded. Once more to her nostrils came the smell of mildewed straw. Mitzi Godiva was back in the barn. "Horses! Stupid, hay-munching beasts of dry land! If only they were seahorses, that would be different." "Seahorses," mused Mitzi. "A glorious idea. I shall go at the horse from the nautical angle." In a giddy frenzy of excitement, she plunged into the problems of equestrian aquatics. She swam horses across ponds, and she swam them into harbors. She dived them from the chalk cliffs and fed them on seaweed. When her horses had become thoroughly at home in the water, Mitzi was ready for her great experiment. She designed and constructed a horse-propelled rowboat, and she named it the Peeping Jack, in honor of her sweetheart. It was a beautiful thing, far ahead of its time, and generally speaking, it worked like a charm. It was not the lack of seahorse power that made the craft a failure. It was the hammer, hammer, hammer on the oak hard treads. When every voyage was halfway through, the horse came down with hoof burn. The Peeping Jack was a one-way cruiser. Mitzi sank it and faced the whole problem anew. One blustery day in the following March, Mitzi slipped moorings and headed up the river in the Peeping Jack too. Mitzi at the tiller, Clover on the treadmill, and Dapples, the spare mare, perched high in the poop. Against a stiff swirling current, Clover pushed on. In 3 hours, she clocked off a good 13 knots. Then she stopped. It was hoof burn. "Dapples," commanded Mitzi, smiling and confident. "Take your trick on the treadmill. Climb down and go forward." It was a wonderful scheme, and it ought to have worked. And it would have if Dapples had followed Mitzi's instructions. But instead of passing sideways according to plan, Dapples attempted to go over Clover. A most disastrous piece of horseplay ensued. The wreckage of the Peeping Jack II was swept down the river. No one ever saw what happened to the horses, but her sisters saw Mitzi as she bounced down the rapids, clinging to some flotsam, headed hell-bent for sea. "Here's one for the book," her voice came back in anguish. "Never change horses in the middle of the stream." Several days later, she was picked up off Guernsey, oddly enough, by the bouncing Queen Maeve, and the sailor who saved her was good Peeping Jack. They were married at sea by the captain. Chapter 6. Lulu Godiva. On the 16th of April, 1078, Lulu Godiva was kicked by her horse, fairly and squarely smacked in the hayloft. In the hay, to her amazement, she found Peeping Drexel's diamond stick pin. He had lost it there, a trysting on a previous occasion. Thus Lulu discovered that horseshoes are lucky. Lulu Godiva made a beeline for the oath book. She jotted down her horse truth and left the place forever. Chapter 7. Gussie Godiva. The sisters Godiva had dwindled to 2. 10 winters had passed since Lulu had wed Drexel. Gussie and Hedwig were still deep in toil, fruitlessly groping for truths in the stables. Hedwig Godiva, placid and hopeful, faced each day with new patience and faith. But Gussie took to thinking too much about love. Repressed, she smoldered with passions galore. Each night she dreamed dreams unbecoming of a maiden. Awaking in anguish, she would light a taper and brood the night through, staring at the portrait of Peeping Sylvester. "Come to me, loved one," his likeness would whisper. "Come to me, sweet, and the hell with your oath." "Dear handsome," she would sigh, "if only I dared." In 1091, just 3 nights before Michaelmas, Gussie gave in to her turbulent urge. She tore up her bedclothes to make an escape rope and lowered herself furtively from her high turret window. It was the night of Peeping Sylvester's birthday. Oath or no oath, she was going to surprise him. As it worked out, however, she surprised only Hedwig, who was a very light sleeper. "You climb," snapped Hedwig, "straight back up those bed sheets. And from now on, young lady, you'll be watched every minute." More frustrated than ever, poor Gussie climbed back. To elude the sharp eye of Hedwig, she realized was impossible. There were no two ways about it. She would have to find a horse truth. She cudgeled her brains as she never had before. Her mind galloped wild along the most amazing thought lanes. By dawn, she had her horse truth. A strange one, perhaps, but entirely legitimate. Hedwig, spying from a wagon, saw Gussie approaching, eyes ablaze. She swept on toward the stables. She clutched a mysterious bundle tight to her breast, hair streaming behind her. Gussie vanished inside. The ancient barn door shut behind her with a slam. For a moment, breathless silence. Hedwig strained hard to hear. Through the walls came the sudden sound of commotion, the crinkle and the crackle of wrapping paper ripping, the uneasy scuffle of a score of nervous hooves, a splashing of liquids, a terrified whinny. The door of the stable burst wide open. Out into the world hurtled Gussie Godiva, clinging to the back of a screaming mad nag, painted forelock to fetlock, a dizzy blue-green. "That," she was shrieking, "is my contribution. That is a horse of another color." As she streaked down the road like a lunatic comet, the giddiest Godiva broke into song. The staid hills of Coventry blushed as they heard her body and raucous and badly off-key. "Hi, diddle duster, ho, diddle dum, Peeping Sylvester, here I come." Chapter 8, and the final chapter in this lovely tale. You are listening to Fallen Woman at Radio Free Brooklyn, and I am reading you the story written by Dr. Seuss in 1939, The Seven Lady Godivas. We are to the final Godiva, and this chapter is called Hedwig Godiva. Neither Hedwig nor Peeping Frailyhusen was getting any younger. At 70, he had lost his job teaching harp at the country day school. When his fingers had stiffened, the school board let him go. "Now I can spend my whole time," he wrote Hedwig, "making plans for our marriage." Every warm day the faithful old lover would pack up his basket and trudge with his dog to the top of the hill. There he would lie all day long in the sunshine, gazing far away at the Castle Godiva. Its turrets still rose high, but no longer quite so proudly. Here and there a crumbling battlement had fallen into the moat. The bell in the watchtower was muted with fungus. Everywhere grew blackthorn, sourgrass, and nink. The Castle Godiva was going to pot. With her bed and her bureau, Hedwig had long ago moved into the barn. Each day her situation was growing more critical. Time had been taking its toll in the stables. On December 31st, 1105, she was down to her very last horse. Parsifal! And the poor antique gelding was at death's door with the grip. Yet Without frenzy, without panic, Hedwig attended to the failing steed's needs, dosing him hourly with bowls of hot hippograss, bundling him on the half hour in newly warmed straw. And as the year was dying, Parsifal seemed just a little stronger. Hedwig, for the tonic effect it might have on his spirits, got out her horn and blew the new year in. It was not just a blast that she blew, but a prayer. The hopes of a lifetime went into that horn, and something within Parsifal responded to the call. Hedwig finally went to bed smiling. She had pulled him through his crisis. Parsifal would live. He did live, but Hedwig never saw him again. While she lay deep in the sleep of exhaustion, horse thieves stealthily broke in. An hour before dawn, Hedwig woke with a start. Parsifal's box stall was empty. Her last horse was gone. Any other woman would have dissolved into tears, but Hedwig Godiva was not that kind. From the depths of an impossible situation, she rose to pluck a horse truth out of thin air. "Don't," she exclaimed as she went out and did it. "Lock the barn door after the horse has been stolen." The stars over Coventry winked as they watched her. With age mellowed, bridal veil crammed in a satchel, she plunged humming through the snowdrifts to the cottage of her ever patient peeping. You have been listening to Dr. Seuss's The Seven Lady Godivas, read by myself, bedtime story style, Velocity Child, for Fallen Woman on Radio Free Brooklyn. And now, a couple more stories to tell of a more personal and bizarre nature. Stay tuned. I called the hotline on day 3 of my odd illness. The first time I called was on day 1. Being in a foreign country so far from home made this peculiar illness even worse. The hotline previously told me after 30 minutes of questioning that I had the neurovirus and that all of the vomiting and diarrhea would be over in 24 hours. By the third day, I was raging a fever of 104, and my face had broken out into a tribal pattern. I was sucking on ice cubes to stay hydrated because I couldn't keep water down, and everything coming out the other end was black as night. I lied to the operator. I told her I couldn't breathe, so this time she would send an ambulance and I could be looked at in person. The crew who arrived were very polite and extremely worried, but I could tell they were trying to hide it. This wasn't how I planned to get a tour of London, but I'd never been in an ambulance before. I even had one of the EMTs take a photo of me giving the horns up sign while I was on the gurney. My brain was already beginning to slip into a delirium, and I couldn't see the severity of it all. As usual, I was making funny when things got scary. Once I was in the ER, they were asking if I had been anywhere exotic recently, or if I had inserted anything unusual into any orifices. I couldn't stop laughing. It was like church giggles mixed with my brain melting. They needed to make sure I hadn't forgotten a tampon or something and began a pelvic exam. That is when everything began to fade into the background and I began to travel. I woke up in bondage, being force-fed by a team of specialists in an institution for wayward wives. I was being programmed for obedience, mind control, and servitude. Every so often, my husband would enter the room only to be pushed out by an orderly because I hadn't responded to the programming yet. The woman torturing me with the force feeding was quoting the Bible over and over again until I decided to shit the bed in protest. As she screamed holy murder, the bed itself cracked open and swallowed me whole, and I felt myself falling down an endless hole. Was I going to hell? Was this a rabbit hole? Will there be a light? I floated in midair, lingering in the dark. I began to slip away until I saw a candlelight walking towards me. The glow illuminated a woman in religious robes and a shaved head with a bell she was ringing in the other hand. She spoke softly close to my ear. She explained to me that I had joined this cult a month ago and had forgotten their de-identification initiation. If I didn't surrender to the process, she told me, I would evaporate. And as I thought about it, I saw my fingers disappearing. My screams were evaporating too and began to float along with me in the darkness. As she blew out the candle, I heard her say, "Lights out." I woke up in a cage. It was a big crate-like cage. I could hear the crying girls all around me. We were moving. We were in motion. We were loaded in the back of a delivery truck. One by one, the crying ceased, as one by one, they were delivered to their designated doorstep. We were all naked, sex slaves, sold on the internet, shipped like cargo. The truck jolted as we hit a speed bump, I think. Whatever we drove over was big enough that the door flew open and my crate smashed into a million pieces on the asphalt. I looked around and was shocked to see I was back in Soho, New York. I don't remember being on a plane or a boat, but somehow, I was back in New York. I walked into a diner, but it looked like a nightclub. I was led to the back where there was an art gallery, and that's when she snuck up behind me and hit me over the head with a baseball bat. I woke up, and I was underwater, tethered by my ankle to a shiny pink castle on the bottom of this giant tank. I looked around and saw other people tethered to other castles, all of them underwater. They were all dressed like Disney princesses. I looked down at my own gown, and I was Sleeping Beauty, a dead prince, bloated and floating, drifted by. I could hear voices from above the water. They were worried I was going to die like the other princesses because I couldn't breathe underwater. I snapped out of my daze I was in and swam to the bottom of the tank. I pulled the plug on the drain and was sucked out of the tank in the art installation and ran home. When I got there, my husband came to the door dressed like the church lady from Saturday Night Live. He had a remote control and was using it on me. All of my limbs were being controlled by this remote control. I walked all the way back to the initial institution for wayward wives, and they pumped me full of drugs upon entering the building. The next thing I knew, I was strapped down in the hospital bed with a burning fever. My husband entered the room with an Asian hooker who started pissing on a maxi pad and began wiping my sweat-soaked brow with it. She then put pasties all over my body laced with rohifenol. I woke up, and there was a gun in my face. He told me if I wanted to live, I had to stop screaming. I was so thirsty, I just wanted water, but no one would give me anything but Tang. And it was powder only. He cocked the gun against my head and pulled the trigger. I woke up. It was 3 a.m. on the clock on the wall. I was alone, it was quiet, and tubes were coming out of me. I couldn't touch my face because I couldn't lift my arms. They weighed 100 pounds each. I saw a shiny red button next to my finger and pushed it. A nurse came to my side, like an angel in the darkness. "Where am I?" "London Hospital," she said. "What happened?" "You were very sick. Blood poisoning." "But the gun, and the pink castles, and the sex slave ring. I'm haunted. What happened? Did I lose myself? My mind?" 10 days, she said. "Don't trouble yourself, love," she said. "It's perfectly normal. It's called ICU psychosis. The drugs are hard to come off of." And it took an additional 3 days before I could be lucid again. She said, I almost didn't make it, and that I was a miracle.
Broken doll. Metal.
My name is Velocity Child. Every Thursday at the stroke of midnight, step into the parlor of Fallen Woman, a weekly soiree of artists on the fringe with underground thoughts and voices shared with uncensored abandon through provocative opinions, seductive humor, candor, and song.